Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Martell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Chapter 21. Suddenly, the silence was shattered. Bells rang, sirens shrieked, whistles screamed. Every radio in Visiset and communicator in or on or near the city of Kondalek began to clamor. All were giving the same dire warning, the alarm extraordinary of invasion, of imminent and catastrophic danger from the air. Seaton leaped toward the nearest elevator, but whirled back toward the Skylark even before Dunark spoke. "Don't try it, Dick. You can't possibly make it. Everyone will have time to reach the bomb proofs. They'll be safe. If we can keep the Mardinalians from landing." "They won't land except in hell." The three sprang into the Skylark, Seaton going to the board, Crane and Duquesne to the guns. Crane picked up his microphone. "Send in English and tell the girls not to answer," Seaton directed. "They can locate calls to a foot. Just tell them we're safe to sit tight while we wipe out this gang of high binders that's coming." Duquesne was breaking out box after box of belts of ammunition. "What do you want first, Seaton? There's not enough of any one load to fight much of a battle." "Start with Mark V's gun. Go up to 10s. That ought to be enough. If not, follow up with 4s and so on down. 5s to 10s, 4s and down. Check." There was a crescendo whine of enormous propellers, followed by a concussion of sound as one wing of the palace disappeared in a cloud of dust and debris. The air was full of Mardinalian warships. They were huge vessels, each mounting hundreds of guns, and a rain of high explosive shells was reducing the entire city to ruins. "Hold it." Seaton's hand, already on the lever, was checked. "Look at the Condal. Something's up." Dunark sat at his board, and every man of his crew was at his station. But all were writhing in agony, completely unable to control their movements. As Seaton finished speaking, the Condalians seized their agonized struggling and hung, unconscious or dead, from whatever each was holding. "They've got to them some way. Let's go," Seaton yelled. The dock beneath them fell apart, and all three men thought the end of the world had come as a stream of shells struck the Skylark and exploded. But that four-foot armor of Aranac was impregnable, and Seaton lifted his ship upward directly into the Mardinalian fleet. Duquesne and Crane fired carefully, as rapidly as each could, consistent with making every bullet count, and as each bullet struck, a warship disappeared, and there erupted a blast of noise in which the explosions of the Mardinalian shells, violent as they were completely inaudible. "You haven't got the repellers on, Dick," Crane snapped. "No, damn it, what a brain." He snapped them on, then as the unbearable din subsided to almost a murmur, he shouted, "Hey, they must be repelling even most of the air." The Skylark was now being attacked by every ship of the Mardinalian fleet, every unit having been diverted from its mission of destruction to the task of wiping out this appallingly deadly, appallingly invulnerable midget. From every point of the compass, from above and below, came torrents of shells, and nor were there shells alone. There came also guided missiles, tight beam radio steered airplane torpedoes carrying warheads of fantastic power, but none of them struck Aranac. Instead, they all struck an immaterial wall of pure force and exploded 100 feet off target, creating an almost continuous glare of fury and flame. And Crane and Duquesne kept on firing. Half of the invading fleet had been destroyed, and they were now using Mark VIs and Mark VIIs, and anything struck by a VII was not merely blown to bits, it was comminuted, disintegrated, volatilized, almost dematerialized. Suddenly the shelling stopped and the Skylark was enveloped in a blinding glare from 1,000 projectors, an intense, searching violet light that would burn flesh and sear its way through eyelids and eyeballs into the very brain. "Shut your eyes!" Seaton yelled as he shoved the lever forward. "Turn your heads!" Then they were out in space. "That's pretty nearly atomic bomb flash," Duquesne said incredulously. "How can they generate that kind of stuff here?" "I don't know," Seaton said, "but that isn't the question. What can we do about it?" The three talked briefly, then put on spacesuits, which they smeared liberally with thick red paint. Under their helmets, they wore extra-heavy welding goggles, so dark in color as to be almost black. "This'll stop that kind of monkey business," Seaton exulted, as he again threw the Skylark into the Mardinalian fleet. It took about 15 seconds for the enemy to get their projectors focused, during which time some 20 battleships were volatilized, but this time the killing light was not alone. The men heard or rather felt a low, intense vibration, like a silent wave of sound, a vibration which smote upon the eardrums as no possible sound could smite, a vibration that racked the joints, tortured the nerves, as though the whole body were being disintegrated. So sudden and terrible was the effect that Seaton uttered an involuntary yelp of surprise and pain as he once more fled to the safety of space. "What the devil was that?" Duquesne demanded. "Can they generate and project infrasound?" "Yes," Seaton replied. "They can do a lot of things that we can't." "If we had some fur suits," Crane began, then paused. "Put on all the clothes we can and use our earplugs?" "We can do better than that, I think." Seaton studied his board. "I'll short out this resistor so as to put more juice through the repellers, and I can get a pretty good vacuum that way, certainly good enough to stop any wave propagated through air." Back within range of the enemy, Duquesne, reaching for his gun, leaped away from it with a yell. "Beat it!" Once more at a safe distance, Duquesne explained. "That gun had voltage, and plenty of it. It's lucky I'm so used to handling hot stuff that I never really make contact with anything at first touch. That's easy, though. Thick, dry gloves and rubber shields is all we need. It's a good thing for all of us that you have those fancy handles on your levers, Seaton." "That must have been how they got Dunark and his crew. But why didn't they get you two, then? Oh, I see. They had it tuned to iridium. They don't know anything about steel, unless they chipped a sample off somewhere. So it took them until now to tune to it." "You recognize everything that happens," Crane said. "Can you tell us what they're going to do next?" Not quite everything. This last one was new. It must be the big new one Dunark was worrying about. The others, yes. But the defenses against them are purely Condalian in technique and material. So we have to roll our own as we go. As to what's coming next..." He paused in thought, then went on. "I wish I knew. You see, I got too many new things at once, so most of them are like dimly remembered things that flash into real knowledge only when they happen. But maybe mentioning something would do the trick. Well, let's see. Now, what have they given us so far?" "They've given us plenty," Duquesne said admiringly. "Light, ultra and visible, sound, infra or subsound, and solid jolts of high-tension electricity. They haven't yet used X-rays, accelerated particles, Hertzian waves, infrared, heat." "That's it! Heat!" Seaton exclaimed. "They project a wave that sets up induced currents in Aranac. They can melt armor that way, given enough time." "Our refrigerators can handle a lot of heat," Crane said. "They certainly can, the limit being the amount of water on board. And when we run out of water, we can hop over to the ocean and cool the shell off. Are we ready?" They were, and soon the Skylark was again dealing out death and destruction to the enemy vessels. who again turned from the devastation of the helpless city to destroy this tiny but incredibly powerful antagonist. And Duquesne, considerably the faster of the two gunners, was now shooting Mark 10s. And in the starkly incomprehensible violence of those earth-shaking blasts, 10 or 12 battleships usually went into their component atoms instead of only 2 or 3. After only a few minutes, the Skylark's armor began to heat up, and Seaton turned the refrigerators already operating at full rating up to the absolute top 50% overload. Even that was not enough. Although the interior of the ship stayed comfortably cool, the armor was so thick that it simply could not conduct heat fast enough. The outer layers grew hotter and hotter. Red, cherry red, white. The ends of the rifle barrels, set flush with the surfaces of the Aranac globes holding them, began to soften and to melt, so that firing became impossible. The copper repellers began to melt and drip away in flaming droplets, so that exploding shells and missiles came closer and closer. "Well, it looks as though they have a stop for the moment," Duquesne said calmly, with no thought of quitting apparent in either voice or manner. "Let's go dope out something else." They again went up out of range, but had only started discussing ways and means when a call came uncoded and on the general wave. "Cardifex Seaton! Cardifex Seaton! Acknowledge, please! Cardifex Seaton! Cardifex Seaton acknowledging! This is Cardifex Depar, commanding 4 task forces. The Carbix Tarnan has ordered me to report." "He has broken radio silence, then?" Seaton demanded. "I have." The Carbix did not go on to explain either that it was necessary or that it was now safe to do so. Seaton knew both of those facts. "Good." And Seaton went on to explain to both Commander-in-Chief and Commander the nature and deadliness of Mardonale's new weapon. "Carfedelix Depar, continue your report." "The Carbix Tarnan ordered me to report to you for orders. There is a Mardonalian fleet approaching from the east. Have I your permission, sir, to attack it?" "Can you insulate against 20 kilovolts? All of the iridium your men must touch?" "I think so, sir." "Thinking isn't enough. If you can't land and get insulation before engaging with any Mardonalian vessel, are any more of our task forces en route?" "Yes, sir. 4 within the quarter hour, 3 more in 1, 2, and 3 hours respectively, sir." "Report acknowledged. Stand by." Seaton frowned in thought. He had to appoint an admiral, but he certainly did not want to ask, with every living Kandalian listening, whether or not this Depar was big enough man for the job. "Carbix Tarnan, sir," he said. "Tarnan acknowledging. Sir, which of your officers, now in air, is best fitted to command the defense fleet now assembling?" "Sir, the Carfedelix Depar." "Sir, thank you." "Carfedelix Depar, I give you authority to handle and responsibility for handling correctly the forthcoming engagement. Take command." "Thank you, sir." Seaton dropped his microphone. "I've got it doped," he told Crane and Duquesne. "The Skylark's faster than any shell ever fired. It has infinitely more mass. She's got 4 feet of Aranac. They have only an inch. Aranac doesn't begin to soften until it's radiating high in the ultraviolet. Strap down solid. This is going to be a rough party from now on." Again, the Skylark went down. Instead of standing still, however, she darted directly at the nearest warship under 20 notches of power. She crashed straight through it without even slowing down. Torn wide open by the 40-foot projectile, its engines wrecked and its helicopter screws and propellers useless, the helpless hulk plunged through 2 miles of air to the ground. Darting here and there, the spaceship tore through vessel after vessel of the Mardonalian fleet. Here indeed was a guided missile, an irresistible projectile housing a human brain, the brain of Richard Seaton, keyed up to its highest pitch and fighting the fight of his life. As the repellers dripped off, the silent waves of sound came in stronger and stronger. He was battered by the terrific impacts, nauseated, almost blacked out by the frightful lurches of his hairpin turns. Nevertheless, with teeth tight locked and with eyes gray and hard as the fracture of high carbon steel, Richard Seaton fought on. Projectile and brain were and remained one. Although it was impossible for the eye to follow the flight of the spaceship, the mechanical sighting devices of the Mardinalians kept her in fair focus, and the projectors continued to hurl into her a considerable fraction of their death-dealing output. Enemy guns were still emitting streams of shells, but unlike the waves, the shells moved so slowly compared to their target that very few found their mark. Many of the great vessels fell to the ground, riddled by the shells of their sister ships. Seaton glanced at his pyrometer. The needle had stopped climbing, well short of the red line marking the fusion point of Aranac. Even as he looked, it began very slowly to recede. There weren't enough Mardinalian ships left to maintain such a temperature. He felt much better, too. The sub-sound was still pretty bad, but it was bearable. In another minute, the battle was over. The few remaining battleships were driving at top speed for home. But even in flight, they continued to destroy. The path of their retreat was a swath of destruction. Half inclined at first to let them escape, Seaton's mind was changed as he saw what they were doing to the countryside beneath them. He shot after them, and not until the last vessel had been destroyed did he drop the Skylark into the area of ruins, which had once been the palace grounds, beside the Condal, which was still lying as it had fallen. After several attempts to steady their whirling senses, the three men were able to walk. They opened the lock and leaped out through the still white-hot wall. Seaton's first act was to call Dorothy, who told him that the royal party would come up as soon as engineers could clear the way. The men then removed their helmets, revealing pale and drawn faces, and turned to the Condal. "There's no way of getting into this thing. Oh, fine. They're coming, too." Dunark opened the lock and stumbled out. "I have to thank you for more than my life this time," he said, his voice shaken as much by emotion as by the shock of his experience, as he grasped the hands of all three men. "I was conscious most of the time and saw most of what happened. You have saved all Condal." "Oh, it's not that bad," Seaton said uncomfortably. "Both nations have been invaded before." "Yes, but not with anything like this. This would have been final. But I must hurry. If you will relinquish command to me, Dick, please, I will restore it to the Carbix. The Condal will, of course, be his flagship." Seaton snapped to attention and saluted. "Carfedix Dunark, sir, I relinquish to you my command." "Carfedix Seaton, sir, with thanks for what you have done, I accept your command." Dunark hurried away, talking as he went with surviving officers of the grounded Condinalian warships. In a few minutes, the Emperor and his party rounded a heap of boulders. Dorothy and Margaret screamed in unison as they saw the haggard faces of their husbands and saw their suits dripping with red. Seaton dodged as Dorothy reached him and tore off his suit. "Nothing but red paint," he assured her as he lifted her off the ground. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the Condalian staring in open-mouthed amazement at the Skylark. He turned. She was a huge ball of frost and snow. As Seaton came back to the girls from shutting off the refrigerators, Roban came up and gave the Earthmen thanks in the name of his nation for what they had done. "Has it yet occurred to you, Carfedix Roban," Margaret said diffidently, that had it not been for your rigid adherence to your code, none of us Tellurians would have been on Oz no more near it when the Mardan aliens attacked you. No, my daughter, by no means. I still fail to see the connection. Will you explain, please? Dick's idea was to have Dunark take the first 8 bars of copper and sail for Mardenale. Then we would take the next 40 bars, which would take about 30 minutes to make, and leave immediately for Earth. Then when Dunark arrived over Mardenale, he would have been shot down out of control, wouldn't he? Undoubtedly. I understand now, but go ahead. How long did it take the Mardenalian fleet to get here, about?
About 40 of your hours.
Then, assuming that Dunark didn't take any time at all in getting over there, we would have been gone about 39.5 hours when they struck. But there wasn't that much time. They must have been well on the way while we were getting the copper.
Very true, Daughter Margaret. But the end result would have been precisely the same. You would have been gone at least 1 hour, which for us would have been as bad as 1,000.
The Carphidix Roban stood facing the party from Earth. Back of him stood his family, the officers and nobility, and a multitude of people.
Is it permitted, Carfido, that I award your captive some small recognition of the service he has done my nation? Roban asked.
It is permitted, Seton and Crane replied in unison, whereupon Roban stepped forward, and after handing Duquesne a heavy bag, fastened about his left wrist the emblem of the Order of Condal.
I welcome you, Carfedelix Duquesne, to the highest nobility of Condal.
He then clasped around Crane's wrist a bracelet of ruby-red material, bearing a peculiarly wrought, heavily jeweled disc, at the sight of which the nobles saluted, and Seton barely concealed a start of surprise.
Carphidix Crane, I bestow upon you this symbol, which proclaims that throughout all Kondalian Osnome, you have authority as my personal representative in all things great and small.
Approaching Seton, Roban held up a bracelet of 7 discs so that everyone could see it. The nobles knelt. The people prostrated themselves.
Carphidix Seton, no language spoken by man possesses words able to express our indebtedness to you in small and partial recognition of that indebtedness. I bestow upon you these symbols, which declare you to be our overlord, the ultimate authority upon all Osnome.
Lifting both arms above his head, he continued,
May the great first cause smile upon you in all of your endeavors until you solve the prime mystery. May your descendants soon reach the ultimate goal. Goodbye.
Seton spoke a few heartfelt words in response, and the 5 Earth people stepped backward toward their ship. As they reached it, the standing emperor and the ranks of nobles snapped into the double salute. Truly, a rare gesture.
What'll we do now? Seton whispered. I'm fresh out of ideas.
Bow, of course, Dorothy said. They bowed deeply and slowly and entered their vessel. And as the Skylark shot into the air, the grand fleet of Kondalian warships fired a royal salute. Please join me next time for the exciting conclusion of The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. In the meantime, watch the skies.